This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. The votes are counted, well, all but a couple dozen or so.
It was a nail-biter, folks, and I'm confident we're going to prevail.
Incumbent Mayor of Normal Chris Koos hopes to hang on to a 7-vote lead over challenger Mark Tiratilli. But when the mail-in ballots are added in a few weeks, it may still not be over.
If there's not an automatic recount, I would request one, yeah.
We'll examine the municipal election results, plus look ahead at what's next in both Normal and Bloomington. We'll preview tomorrow's Be In By The Numbers event and take a close look at the community's housing and employment trends. And two members of the 80s and 90s Central Illinois band The Something Brothers preview this weekend's reunion concert in Bloomington. That and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 5th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Election day has come and gone, but one major race in central Illinois remains undecided. Incumbent Chris Koos outpolled challenger Mark Tiratilli by 7 votes in the race for mayor of Normal. But another 2 weeks looms before the race can be determined. Mail-in ballots are still being received, and the county clerk's office says the deadline for them to be counted is April 18th. Regardless, Koos says the close vote left him stunned and concerned about the message he's receiving from voters.
That's something I'm going to have to think about, because apparently a lot of people are concerned about where the town was headed.
Tiratilli, meanwhile, says if the margin holds for Koos,
if there's not an automatic recount, I would request one, yeah.
Incumbents Kevin McCarthy and Scott Preston won re-election, while Kimberly Cummings became the first African-American to win a council seat in Normal. Terry Renner easily won re-election to a second term as Bloomington mayor, outdistancing challenger Kevin Lauer, who will leave the council after one term as alderman. Renner says there was a pessimism-optimism divide between his and Lauer's campaigns.
You have to be proactive. You have to move your city forward. You can't just say no.
Lauer, meanwhile, says he thinks his campaign sent a message to Renner that many in Bloomington are unhappy. Incumbents Mboka Malabwe and Johnny Painter won re-election, and former Alderman Jamie Maffey regained his Ward 1 seat. Incumbent Scott Black had no opposition, and newcomer Kimberly Bray won in an open race. A wave of political involvement sparked the election of Donald Trump in November has resulted in a big change in Normal's township. After decades of Republican strength, the Democrats took the township supervisor's job and 3 out of 4 trustee positions. Supervisor-elect Sarah Grammer defeated Supervisor candidate Cheryl Gaines. The trustee winners were Democrats Sally Pine, Arlene Jose, and Samantha Quiggle, and Republican Ray Ropp. Incumbent Joe Cleary of Normal and newcomers David Fortner of Carlock and Tanya Leffner of Bloomington earned 4-year seats on the Unit 5 school board. Incumbent Mita Mickens-Baker of Bloomington was elected to serve a 2-year term. 2 incumbents and 2 newcomers will fill 4 seats on Bloomington's District 87 school board. Incumbents Mary Yount and Bridget Beasley won, as did newcomers Elizabeth Fox Anvik and Chuck Irwin. All seats are for 4-year terms. And an incumbent lost his seat on the Heartland Community College Board of Trustees. James Drew finished 3rd in a 4-way race for 2 6-year terms. Incumbent Chair Greg Chadwick won re-election, but finished a distant 2nd to challenger Mary Campbell, who wins a board seat. Challenger Bennett Morris rounded out the voting. GLT's Charlie Schlenker anchored election night coverage on GLT and joins us in the studio now. Charlie, we hear there are about 35 or so mail-in ballots still to be returned to the McLean County Clerk's Office. They had to have been postmarked by yesterday to be counted. This doesn't necessarily mean there are 35 votes, though, still out there for the race in Normal, does it?
No. In a lot of cases, a few of those votes don't come in. We do know, according to the county clerk, that about 13 of them arrived in the mail today, and more will likely appear tomorrow. After that, it tends to tail off because the Postal Service usually gets its job done. The 2-week period is a period out of an abundance of caution. There are also 4 provisional ballots, ballots whose voters had some question about the validity of their registration that also have to be researched. It's likely that we'll have to wait 2 weeks to find out the total. I talked with Ken Menzel, the general counsel of the State Elections Board, this morning, and he said county clerks don't have to wait to tally them, but they usually don't like to pick up one piece of lint and then another piece of lint and then another piece of lint off the floor. They usually like to clean the floor all at the same time because there is some legal ramp-up notification to the parties involved, and they generally want to do it all at once. There's also a voter secrecy reason, because if one vote in one precinct gets mailed in, then it is possible by looking at the rolls of people who have voted to determine who cast that ballot.
And because the mail-in then would be public record, right? Who actually cast that ballot would be public
record? No, but the someone who's interested could ascertain a before and after look of the voting rolls of who voted and find out the difference.
So gotcha.
In effect, it's public.
Now, in this race for mayor of Normal, incumbent Chris Coos and challenger Mark Tiratilli say they'll ask for a recount if the final vote has them losing. What happens if either, actually only one of them, will request a recount? What happens if that does occur?
Well, nothing happens really till April 25th when the vote is canvassed. And the winner at that time, a declared winner, can be challenged. The loser can ask for a discovery recount, and that involves 25% of the precincts in any given election district.
And who determines which 25%?
The challenger does, and the challenger typically cherry-picks precincts, in this case up to six or seven precincts out of the entire town of Normal, that they think there might be grounds or evidence to suggest that they might get a few votes here or there. They'll recount those. They'll examine the ballots they're entitled to. The recount itself is fairly quick because you just run them through the machines again. But you look at the ballots, you determine whether there's been any irregularity, and you try to get evidence that you can take to a judge and say, hey, judge, there's a reason to believe that the result of this election would be overturned if these ballots were to be tossed out or would go the other way, and that a similar number of ballots would go the other way in the rest of the precincts that we haven't yet taken a look at. That gets costly. The cost for a discovery recount is only about $10 a precinct.
Well, what happens at the end of the month? Because the mayor's term is over. Mayor Coos's term ends at the end of April. If this isn't decided by then, what happens?
A winner would be declared. That winner would be seated, and the challenge would proceed, and they would perhaps be unseated, although it's really rather rare that that happens. It's rare that mail-in ballots change the way the system works either, because those generally reflect the outcome of the voting on the day, and that, of course, was closely divided.
Now, over in Bloomington, Mayor Renner is claiming a mandate now, and most of the council winners yesterday seemed to at least be somewhat progressive. Renner is hinting at revisiting the downtown hotel issue, which kind of idled during the campaign. What could keep him from pushing forward, as he put it in a GLT interview last night?
Nothing but the lack of a good proposal. The council was fairly progressive even before, with Kevin Lauer and maybe Alderman David Sage being the more conservative members. But the council was really pretty progressive already. So, but they also didn't bite on a previous hotel proposal. So it's going to have to be a good proposal to get acceptance. The town or the city of Bloomington is also remains limited by its budget situation, and that's not going to change, or the commitment to do streets and pensions ahead of most other things.
We have just a couple of minutes left here, but I want to touch on what happened in this Normal township, these races there, and we don't really ever pay attention to races like that, way down on the ballot. But there were so many Democrats and so many Libertarians that were on the ballot. And this year, a Democrat won for supervisor, and the party took three of the four trustee slots. Is this just merely Trump backlash that's going to fade out, do you think? Or is there a movement here that the Republicans in McLean County, entrenched as they are, need to watch out and fight back against?
Well, let me trot out the old time will tell cliche. We just don't know. I think it's too early to write off the Republicans. I think it will be, as Sarah Grammer, the winning township supervisor candidate, said, will remain a closely contested election district. What we saw in this election was higher student turnout than 4 years ago, and that made a difference in Sarah Grammer's race and possibly in the township races as well. There was a student on the ballot in who finished fifth, so very close to the money in the township trustees race. That matters. GOP township folks perhaps also weren't that aware that they needed to work very hard for this because they've never had to before.
And it appears they may have to in the future. Charlie, thanks. Charlie Schlinker is the incoming news director, and he anchored last night's GLT election coverage. You're tuned to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern.
Support for GLT comes from Retrofit Culture, breathing new life into the old Westside Clothing Building with vintage and handmade goods, many of which are sourced locally. Accessible from Constitution Trail at 1014 West Washington in Bloomington. This is GLT.
You're tuned to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Every quarter, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council presents its BN by the Numbers Luncheon, spotlighting a segment of the Central Illinois economy. This quarter's event, over the noon hour tomorrow in Normal, features a keynote address from Rob Carr, the head of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. At the event, attendees will be briefed on the latest data driving economic factors in Bloomington Normal. Mike Doherty, senior economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau, will update the numbers in two major areas: unemployment and housing. Doherty says because of the timing of this quarter's event, there's not much data from March to be included. He says there has been a slight gain in new home sales.
A slight gain over last year, and the closing price was up slightly on those homes, too. Looking at the resale market, which is a much bigger market, and we had a gain in the number sold over last year's January-February period, and we also had a gain in the average selling price at that time.
As far as the new homes go, we're looking at about a 5.7% increase for those homes, which I guess when you consider a small sample size, what does that tell you?
To me, it's too small of a sample for that to really mean very much. I mean, just one or two homes would make it, you know, would give you that percentage increase. And we had a warm winter, so I was kind of expecting a bump up just because of the warmer temperatures.
So when you consider where we are now compared to last year, how does that stack up to where we were a year ago, looking back at 2015?
Right. I was comparing the numbers for the end of 2016, so all of 2016, to all of 2015, and found that of the new homes market, we had a nearly 7% decrease in the number of the new homes built, but we had an increase in the average selling price slightly, a 2% increase. For the resale homes market, which is a much, much bigger market, we had a 2.3% gain in the total number of homes resold, but we did not have any appreciable gain in the average selling price. People need to be aware when you hear that, it does not mean that each person's home did not gain in value, because we do not know whether or not what consumers were buying and looking for shifted. Maybe they were looking for a slightly cheaper home, but it's an indicator. We did not have much appreciation in our real estate housing values here over the course of 2016.
So if you're going to draw the bottom line, how does the situation compare, the gains or losses made over the last year compared to the year before that?
Well, it's obviously flattened out or remained flat, which is to be expected. We had a loss of a significant employer over the last 2 years, and starting back in November of 2015.
You're talking about Mitsubishi.
Mitsubishi. And I think that's what, when you look at the employment numbers, it's pretty obvious that you would not expect much of a gain in the housing price. It the two. It's reflective of the labor market here in Bloomington Normal.
So that leads us right into the next segment we're going to look at here on BN by the Numbers, and that is the labor force. And things really aren't great there. I guess Mitsubishi has a lot to do with that. There are some struggles that are going on for the first part of this year compared to a year ago. Where are some of these?
Right. January and February, we had an uptick in unemployment, but so did all the surrounding communities, and or most of them, metro areas downstate. With the and Peoria and Decatur had an even bigger uptick in unemployment than Bloomington Normal had. We had a similar uptick in unemployment last year in January and February. Of course, to some extent, that reflected the closing of that Mitsubishi plant just prior to that in November. So that said, I'm not too worried about this recent uptick for January and February of unemployment. When it given the fact that we had it to some extent occur statewide or throughout the downstate, given the fact that we had a similar uptick last year but then got back to low unemployment numbers later in the year, I think we'll probably see us get back to low unemployment numbers again. So it's not really that high. It's still 6% is not a really high unemployment number. On the other hand, it was a continuing decrease in labor force numbers.
Okay, make a distinction for us then between what you mean when you say labor force and unemployment.
So you start out with your population as a whole, and you subtract the elderly and the children or adolescents under the age of 18 who you expect to not be working. So that brings you down to a group of people that are either working or they're unemployed, or they may be busy and doing something, but they're not working for cash. So there you go. What would that be? They would be students, maybe at Heartland, maybe at ISU. They could be stay-at-home parents taking care of the kids or taking care of an elderly and not being paid cash for that. So they're not unemployed, and in the sense that they're not going down to the unemployment office, and they're also not – they don't show up in the labor force. So they are one more group outside of – the labor force.
Basically, they're invisible to the people who look at the labor markets.
Right. And then what you have left after you take that group out, then you have the labor force. So labor force basically means unemployed plus employed.
And since this is a long year trend, is there anything you could make how this situation compares with what we were looking at a year ago as far as the changes from 2015?
It's not significantly different.
Okay.
It fits within the trend line. There's some like I say, we've had an uptick in the unemployment rate, so that means we had labor force moving along the same trend line. However, we had a drop in employment numbers. So what I saw in these numbers that, well, we'll see how significant it plays out, but if you look at December, January, and February employment numbers, so those are the real update for the meeting tomorrow. Those numbers, we saw a decrease in the total number employed. So that drove up our unemployment rate a little bit.
And I know you're going to have some information available. We don't really have it now, but you're going to have it available tomorrow at the event, the BN by the Numbers event, relating to manufacturing and some of the industry sectors. I would guess that with the Mitsubishi departure now being more than a year old, we would start to see some of that showing up in some of these figures, right? I mean, manufacturing has to be going way down in this community because that was such a big part of that sector.
Right. And it's gone down. And those numbers have been absorbed or reflected in the numbers we now have, and they've been there basically since June of last year when the plant was finally completely closed. Then we've got we also have as a backdrop the decline in manufacturing throughout the state of Illinois. Illinois has been leading the manufacturing loss, leading loss state compared to the other Midwest states in manufacturing jobs. So that's one change. While at the same time here in Bloomington Normal, what's balanced that, and this has also been true for the state, also true for Chicago, has been an increase in service industry jobs and especially healthcare. So that begs the question, what happened over just the last few months that we had a decrease in employment? I don't know that we'll have that specific an update within the retail sector or within the service sector. What happened that we had a decrease in the total employment? I'm guessing retail was probably softer over Christmas than what we were hoping for, and they cut back there.
That's Mike Doherty, the senior economist with the Bloomington-based Illinois Farm Bureau. He'll present the latest set of BN by the numbers at tomorrow's Economic Development Council event, slated for noon at ISU's Bone Student Center Prairie Room. The keynote speaker is Rob Carr with the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. If you were among those who headed out in the 80s and 90s and danced to the music of the Something Brothers here in Bloomington Normal, you want to hear John Norton's interview with two members of the band reunited this weekend for a benefit concert at the Castle Theater. That's just ahead. 8 years ago, Bitcoin was an experimental technology of interest to niche enthusiasts only. The digital currency is much bigger now. It's traded worldwide, and there's even a business presence for it here in central Illinois. Joe Ciccolo of Bloomington Normal is a Bitcoin consultant. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Ciccolo talks about what he does and where things are going.
I consult with various Bitcoin entrepreneurs with respect to their compliance and regulatory obligations. Early on, there were a lot of tech anarchists and sort of rebels, if you will, in the Bitcoin space. And I like to think that they've since been replaced by entrepreneurs. And through that movement, we've seen a lot of folks come into the marketplace with various different ideas, products, and services, and fascinating business models. But you have to understand that this is in the world of financial services where there's some serious regulatory implications. And so I work with my clients to understand what the requirements are in terms of regulations and how best to comply with them.
What are some of the business models of the people you deal with?
Sure. So we deal with a lot of Bitcoin ATM operators. So just as the name might imply, it's sort of a take on the legacy ATMs, as it were, today, that are retrofitted to do a transaction into and out of Bitcoin. I also work with Bitcoin exchanges, much like a currency exchange. Maybe you'll see one at an airport or a mall. Very similar. In this case, they're all online, and they deal with the exchange of fiat or dollar-based currency for Bitcoin and vice versa.
Governments couldn't figure out what to do at first. They decidedly didn't like the idea of not being able to tax this trading that was going on. Regulation has started to creep in. Talk a little bit about the regulatory landscape now. What sorts of safeguards are there, and how does entrepreneurial behavior still happen in less than a Wild West fashion?
Sure. Yeah, so that's a bit of a misconception. There is quite a bit of regulation around the actors, folks that have entrepreneurial ventures within the Bitcoin space. So it's a veritable alphabet soup, if you will, of government agencies that are involved. We have FinCEN, which is Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. It's an arm of the U.S. Treasury. They enforce Bitcoin exchanges and ATMs and other means of getting into and out of Bitcoin, and they interpret that activity as money transmitter activity. We also have the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, that has said in certain cases Bitcoin is a commodity.
Not a security, but a commodity.
A commodity, right. It's funny you mentioned securities. The SEC has also weighed in certain circumstances. Bitcoin, depending on how it is offered, could be considered a security. And then for tax purposes, the IRS has said Bitcoin is property. And so I joke with my clients and friends in the industry, anytime someone asks, well, which is it? I say all of the above.
Obviously, you can do business anywhere because it's an online business and a consulting business. You've chosen to live in Bloomington Normal. Why? What makes Bloomington Normal great for a Bitcoin entrepreneur?
That's a great question. No, it's actually a great location. I tell my clients that I'm halfway between St. Louis and Chicago, both of which are really strong markets for the Bitcoin and the payment space. I really enjoy the quality of life here in Bloomington Normal. So that's kept me anchored down here.
What kinds of businesses use Bitcoin?
Merchants could accept Bitcoin. There are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands at this point internationally, of merchants that accept Bitcoin. It's a great way to avoid chargebacks, which I know is something of a four-letter word in the area of retail. So you can avoid chargebacks. The swipe fee is not there as it would be for a credit card, where you could pay, in some cases I've heard, up to 3% per transaction goes to the credit card company and the various institutions involved in that transaction. So there's an obvious benefit for retailers to accept Bitcoin, and not to mention it opens you up to a new population of prospective customers that may not necessarily have used your services before. So Overstock.com is a great example. They would readily admit that they have appealed towards a more female audience in terms of where they position themselves in the marketplace. By opening up to techies and to folks that may not necessarily fit their profile for a customer, they've really introduced a new set of customers that wouldn't otherwise use their services. So retail would definitely benefit. I think the best area that Bitcoin is suited for is international remittances, because the system we have now just doesn't work. It's broken. You're waiting, in some cases, 5 to 7 days to send a transaction somewhere else in the world. And when we have a very globalized society, we have a lot of immigrants sending money home to families. They have to rely on a system of many different actors and place their trust in those actors in that system in order to send funds home. And not to mention the exorbitant rates that in some cases they're charged for that service, when in fact they can do it instantaneously from their smartphone using Bitcoin.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Joe Ciccolo, a Bitcoin entrepreneur and consultant, about the business of cryptocurrency. How much has use of Bitcoin expanded in the last 8 years, and how stable is it now? It used to have larger fluctuations in value.
Sure. I think early on it was something of an anomaly. I think a lot of techies were using it. There was a lot of reticence in terms of adoption by the folks that are in more of a mainstream situation versus some of the tech players out there who were living and breathing the technology. They understood cryptographic technology and consensus algorithms and some of those technical terms that were very difficult to sell to the average person. And I think over time, as we begin to see the utility and the application of Bitcoin, you've seen a dramatic increase in adoption.
Ordinary currencies are backed by governments. Some items are backed by bullion or some other good that it securitizes it. How is Bitcoin backed?
Bitcoin is backed by math. It's backed by mathematical principles. It is software. It's an open source program. Anyone can download the code and examine it. Several people have. There is no backing to it in terms of, obviously, government authority. It's completely decentralized. And so it's trust in the system and trust in people that are involved in the system. The number of Bitcoins will be capped at 21 million. It's embedded in the code. So consider that a mathematical formula. There's 21 million Bitcoin that will ever exist. There'll never be more. There'll never be less. And they're mined into existence on a predictable scale in accordance with the software program.
There is increasing competition in cryptocurrencies. China has begun to look at issuing its own cryptocurrency. It really didn't like Bitcoin all that much. And there is an Australian mining firm that is issuing its own Oz currency that is backed by gold. What is the competitive landscape for cryptocurrencies, and how do you see it developing?
I think in terms of participants, it's very competitive. But in terms of actual results, Bitcoin has the lion's share of the cryptocurrency market. There are literally thousands of what are called altcoins, the alt standing for alternative. So there are any number of Peercoin, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Dash. The list goes on and on. And many of these are just more pet projects or casual interest. Again, Bitcoin had that first mover advantage. They were able to capture that lion's share of the market. You mentioned some of the other players involved in this. It's no surprise that governments are going to try to issue their own currency. I think we're used to a centralized system of financial services. People have joked that, you know, one day we'll see Fedcoin from the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. That certainly wouldn't surprise me. I think that there is a desire to get involved from government's perspective. I think what it really comes down to is we are going to have digital currency. Is it going to be centralized, decentralized, or both? Right. I think the model of having cash and money in physical form, as I'm sure many of us have experienced on a daily basis, you know, when was the last time we used cash, or how often do we use cash in our daily activities?
Less and less frequently.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think it's going to come down to a digital finance.
So what are the arguments for centralization and decentralization?
So great question. I think the argument against centralization is the intersection between the state and banking that we have now. So there is a lot of oversight of financial activities through the banks. There are a lot of voices within the Bitcoin community very concerned about the authority that the Federal Reserve has over our monetary system. And you can probably read in between the lines, if you will, in the original white paper that was issued when Bitcoin was launched, that there are a lot of overtones and criticisms of the fiscal monetary policy of this country, or sort of more pointedly, the market meltdown of 2008. It's unsurprising that there are those considerations. So that's sort of the downside. When you talk about having, you know, decentralized cryptocurrencies, you don't have any central actor involved. So there's really no appeal to authority. Depending on who you ask, that could be a feature or a bug. So there are definitely those considerations. And I think ultimately we're probably going to have a mix of centralized and decentralized. And it's hard to argue when there are different options out there for different applications.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Joe Ciccolo, a Bitcoin consultant, about cryptocurrencies. The pro is that it's secure and anonymous. The con is that it's secure and anonymous. There have been concerns by any number of governments about Bitcoin being used in illicit trafficking of drugs and other goods. How should people address that concern?
It's a very valid concern. Early on, I think Bitcoin was dominated by headlines about Silk Road, the online marketplace where it seemed you could buy anything under the sun that was illegal, among other things that you could purchase online. And so Bitcoin got a bad name right out of the gate. But I think as people began to explore it and really looked at the technology and looked at the ways in which it was being used, several governments, including the UK Treasury, has come out and said, look, we don't really think that Bitcoin is high risk for terrorist funding or other money laundering activities. And I understand that debate is going to continue to go on. But I think the best way to think about Bitcoin is it's not anonymous, right? I think that's one myth we really have to dispel. It's semi-anonymous. So while you can see the transactional activity on the blockchain in terms of the address of the sender and the receiver, you don't have their personal information, their name, address, and social security number, which is obviously a good thing. We don't want everybody to have that public information, but you are able to see some attributes. And using old-fashioned police activities, law enforcement has been able to, in the case of Silk Road, for example, piece together that activity and be able to trace it back to the illicit actor, or ultimately trace it to a destination that is an entity with which can be served a subpoena.
The U.S. has said, okay, let's regulate it and tax it. Other governments, including several countries in South America, have tried to ban it. That brings into question the use for remittances, at least in those countries. How do you think the landscape among the various nation states is going to shift over time, and why, on the question of whether to accept Bitcoin?
I think it's going to have to shift to an acceptance. There's always going to be regulation there, and there should be. I think you mentioned in South America, I'll take Venezuela, for example, which is obviously going through an unthinkable period in their history right now where there are food shortages, and it seems like the government has lost control of the country, just to put it mildly. And we're seeing in that jurisdiction where energy prices are subsidized by the government, people are mining Bitcoin and collecting that reward, and they are exchanging it for food in neighboring countries and then smuggling it over the border. So people are willing to go to those lengths, obviously, to get food and water and things, the necessities for their family. But you can imagine that power, and how do you ban something when you have people that are willing to do those things, knowing full well that if they were caught by the national police force, what consequences they would pay for that. So Obviously, that's a very stark example, but I think it illustrates the point that it's very hard to come at this from the perspective of prohibition, that it's better in the case of the U.S. to approach this as, okay, we need to regulate this. We're not going to make a judgment. We're not going to say it's good or it's bad. We understand that people have options. We understand that there's a marketplace that needs to thrive. However, we also understand the capabilities that this could be used by illicit actors. So let's put our heads together and come out with some sound and some cogent regulation that works for the marketplace. And I think that the U.S. And Canada in particular and the U.K. are just some examples of nations that have really looked at this from a very reasonable perspective.
Joe Ciccolo is a Bitcoin consultant. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Bitcoin remains a work in progress. The federal government rejected a proposal a couple of weeks ago to create the first Bitcoin exchange-traded fund in U.S. markets. The Securities and Exchange Commission ruled the currency is not ready to be treated as an ordinary commodity because there remains concern about market manipulation. Sudden changes in volume of trading on some Bitcoin exchanges in January also provoked questions of regulatory effectiveness in some countries.
I'm David Collier. Like you, I'm part of many organizations. My GLT contribution also makes me part of a community who believes in substance over sound bites. Every day, I listen to NPR's All Things Considered, Here and Now, and Morning Edition on my commutes. This is how I am assured that I accurately know what is happening in the nation, the world, and locally. Join the GLT community and renew your financial commitment or make a first-time contribution. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
We've heard from hundreds of renewing contributors this year, and we thank them for their support, but we also need to hear from GLT listeners who've never contributed before. Everyone who uses GLT needs to help pay for GLT. Make your first-time contribution now at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at JustinMBoyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
You're tuned to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern, and that's Reno from the Something Brothers album, Me, You, and the Circus. Saturday night at the Castle Theater in Bloomington, the Something Brothers and two other bands who made their mark in Bloomington Normal in the 80s and 90s are going to reunite in a benefit for former manager and booking agent Denny DeBourbon. Mojo Stu and the Mechanics will join the Something Brothers playing songs old and new. Tommy O'Donnell and Ed Pierce are founding members of the Something Brothers. They recently sat down with John Norton in the GLT studios to talk about the show and flash back to some special moments during their heyday.
How many Hausers did you guys tip back?
Oh, God.
Back in the day.
Cheap Hausers. They were cheap, so we tipped a lot of them.
God. Well, Hausers, I think we need to define what they are.
Yeah.
It started with the word beer, and then that became brew, and then that became brewhaus, and then that became brewhauser. And
don't forget tubes.
Tubes. We had many nicknames for beers.
What was the tubes?
Tubes in a can, so there's a tube.
And then that became Hauser. Schaefer beer was our big,
Schaefer.
Was our gasoline back in the day.
I remember
it was cheap, and you could buy it by the cases and drink it.
At the shows, Dean and Scott, boy, they would tip. It was something else.
They could power down a few.
Yes, they could.
I've been changing light bulbs, fixing toilets, mowing grass. All day long been thinking about bars to pour my ass. When five holes round, I'm in my truck, don't even stop at home. I'm gonna meet the Something Brothers.
How many fans over the years have come up to you and said, when are you guys going to get back together and do something?
When the website came up, it seemed like the request became a lot.
I guess it was a fan base. Some fan just started a website and it generated some interest. I don't know how many years back that was, but...
Was it like 10 years ago or 15?
Yeah, maybe 10 years.
Yeah, 8-10 years ago. And then that's when the request and it got active and a lot of people got on there and talked about it.
What was your initial reaction when you started hearing that? It's like, no way, we've been there, done that? Or did it start going, maybe we can do something here?
It had to stew for a while.
A little bit. You know, it had been so many years. By then, you're almost in the looking back with nostalgia glasses, and you know, even 10 years ago, we would still be considered an old band then, let alone now. Just like,
well, is it Danny DeBourbon's health that made, was the final push that for this time?
Well, actually, which I'm going to say thanks to Tom Morgan right now, because he actually came to me and said, hey, remember, you know, back in the day, in the late 80s, we're thinking about, and this is the mechanics we're talking about, we're thinking about doing a reunion show. Would you, would the Sumter Brothers be interested? Well, at the same time, we were talking about Danny, and I kind of was saying maybe we could work that in a little bit. And then we also mentioned Mojo Stew. But anyway, thanks, Tom Morgan, for asking about or getting this going. He's done quite a bit to get to help this out.
Okay.
So he came to us, and then it turned into a triple reunion type of deal.
That voice is Ed Pierce with Tommy O'Donnell, the Sumter Brothers reuniting April 8th at the Castle Theater. Tommy, I'll go to you, but if Ed, you want to answer it, that's fine. Everyone wants to know, who is going to be in the band? Who's here?
Okay, so the Sumter Brothers originally were a six-piece band. There'll be five of us on April 8th. Dean Carlson opted to not be part of this show, and the five of us kind of regrouped and said, well, let's see what it sounds like. And it just, we couldn't deny how good it was sounding, so we just kept going with it. And of course, when we heard about Denny's, you know, Denny needed help with medical bills, and he helped us so much back in the day. That was sort of the impetus of let's try a little harder at this one than just blowing it off. So
Denny taught us a lot. Denny grounded us as well as we could be grounded, because we were off. We were messy, very messy.
Yeah,
and he grounded us. He, you know, kept us contained as well as we could be. Okay.
We were wild young men. Yeah.
So just to I want to get to Denny. So just it's Tommy, Ed, John on drums.
John Ganser will be the on drums. Ed and I on guitars. Scott Wilson
on vocals,
and Greg Pear will be playing bass. And we will we'll have our good buddy Clay Thompson come up and play bass too.
To say, I see his name, picture poking up too. So
Clay was a big part of the band for several years. So there will be six of us that night. Sans Dean Carlson, sadly, but.
Is there any chance we can get Dean at that?
I doubt it. Not for this one, but
we're hoping for the future.
We're going to keep the door open.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just not good timing for Dean at the moment.
Okay. Can I ask you about one song? I think I called you a number of years ago, Ed, about this. I don't know if you remember it, but I picked up a Sumter Brothers. It must have been a CD because I had cassettes where I couldn't have a cassette player in the car, but I heard If Not, Why Not Again. Mm-hmm. And that was my all-time favorite Sumter Brothers song. And you told me that was actually two songs put together.
It was actually three.
Three songs.
Yes, it started out with Scott Wilson. He brought in the beginning chord progression. It was similar to something I was working on. Actually, there was several chords that were together, and I said, well, let's start out with your thing.
3 o'clock in the morning, you're sleeping like a child. I'm seeing double, I look at you and smile. You must be crazy.
And now I showed him the second part, or which became the second part. And Tommy had the big monster riff headbanging part in the middle, and he goes, hey, go check out this.
What, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-part?
No, like the heavy metal thing.
Between
like,
bump, 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 bump,
oh, okay,
bump,
all right.
I was a total metalhead. I still am a metalhead. You know, you can't take that out of me.
But once it gets to that part, it's just like, it just feels this relentless power of that thing. And then it goes back into the, you know, the chill out barroom scene.
I would never think that any song that I was a part of would be in my top 20 songs of all time. But If Not, Why Not?
It's such a great song. You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Ed Pierce and Tommy O'Donnell. They're in studio talking about the Sumter Brothers reunion at the Castle Theater April 8th. Everyone excited about this.
Yay!
Well, let's talk about Danny. You talked about what a grounding influence he was with your grounding at the time. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, You want to?
You know, we were always...
This is Tommy talking now.
Do-it-yourself rock band. I think what Denny did was he saw potential there, and we were able to... We did a lot of things on our own as far as touring and booking shows, and back then, you know, the way rock and roll worked on an independent level was so much different than it is now. I mean, basically because there was no internet, and it was a lot more word of mouth, and trading shows with other bands and things that we did back in the day. I think Denny saw potential in us, and we just had a million original songs. I mean, we could go and play a three-set night and not...
Can I interject?
And do all our own material, and I think he saw something there.
He had a little bit of good fortune to do... Well, he was managing Cool Ray and the Polaroids,
okay.
And they were very successful.
Right.
And we knew that... I knew that they were successful, and... We were, like Tommy was saying, kind of do-it-yourselfer, and we needed that one step up. We needed to step up to the next plate, and ran across Denny and asked him to come listen to us. And I think at first he was probably going, oh, my God, but he saw the light in there.
Because of the so-called sloppiness, you mean?
Just the way, I mean, he had a professional powerhouse band with Cool Ray, and... With us, he was looking at us like, wow, this is a... Talk about Motley Crue. We were pre-Motley Crue, and we were that.
Yeah. He was able to kind of focus us a little bit and get, you know, get us some showcase dates and in front of record companies and all that stuff that managers do that we wouldn't have...
We wouldn't have been able to
we
do
would
it.
Have been like, where, you know,
we were too busy doing the tubes, drinking the Schaefer, and he was on the phone actually talking to New York, and,
yeah.
You know, he got us all the way down south to... Key West, right?
He also worked as a booking agent, so he booked us,
managed and booked
us all over the country. And
well, and he got you to CBGB's too.
Correct.
I remember when that happened, and I was just stunned that hey, Something Brothers are playing CBGB's.
Yeah, we went there a couple times. That was
that was crowning time.
Yeah,
fun place to play.
And there was a couple of New York producers. They were a little bit farther down on the food chain there, but they had connections, and they were talking. It was TVT Records at the time, which is Gottlieb, which turned... His first big one was Nine Inch Nails, and he booked Nine Inch Nails, and then, of course, Trent Reznor went off to do what he did. And locally, Chicago was our big town to break, and when we finally did that with Denny's help, that's where we actually started, I believe, started churning pretty hard and really getting some notoriety. I think we did... Tuesday nights at 1 o'clock and worked our way up to Friday and Saturday nights prime time.
That was it. That would be Chicago Metro.
Yeah, the Metro, Joe Shanahan's club.
Yeah.
And he was managing Smashing Pumpkins at the time.
Well, let's talk about a couple other songs.
Sure.
And I'm not a groupie, so I don't remember all these songs. I got four or five that I remember, actually. But the thing that strikes me is you wrote a number of songs, maybe two or three, that had to do with farms, farming, farm, a grain elevator at the top of our town. You guys wrote songs about farming in farms in the middle of central Illinois that weren't poking fun at farming. You guys were serious about this.
Absolutely.
That this is where you're from.
Farmer Jones is a great example.
Yeah.
That's a very serious song that Scott wrote all the lyrics to. You know, he
knew it. Well, he's a farm.
And he's a country boy.
Country boy.
So,
okay.
They have Scott has a unique look at that, you know.
If you listen to Scott's lyrics, you'll see the beauty in descriptions you get. He's a pretty good describer, really good describer. Both guys were, Dean and Scott, were really good at describing and give you the images and get you in a spot. Yeah.
Listening to GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking with Tommy O'Donnell and Ed Pierce. The Something Brothers reunion is April 8th at the Castle Theater. Well, a lot of the fans, myself included, are really geeked about this show, and it means a lot to them. What does it mean to you guys?
Well, for me, it's like getting the rust off, you know, kicking it in the pants, talking to the guys, all the old stories come up. So it's a lot of fun. I mean, you can imagine the nostalgia in that, and don't want to just live there totally. So, but we get together and we have a good time. I think there's a maturity in our playing where it was kind of messy before and just kind of, I don't want to say haphazard, but it was kind of crazy before. And now it's pretty focused.
Yeah.
I mean, we know how to talk to one another. We focus. Let's work on this part. And we know when things are getting astray and getting... So it's actually pretty dang tight.
You have recorded some new songs recently for an EP. You said that you don't want to recreate the past, even though I've been bringing you back to the 80s a lot here, but you don't want to recreate the past musically. But you still have to keep a Something Brothers framework, don't you, somehow? What is that framework?
I think it's we always had like a songwriting approach that anything could work. It was never pigeonholed. Like I was saying earlier, it was sometimes to the detriment of the band and sometimes to our advantage. Once you got a hold of it as a fan, you could be like, wow, these guys do every kind of thing all in their own original songs. And I think that approach didn't leave. If you listen to the new EP that we did last year, there's sort of a jaggedy punk song called Piss Me Out. And then there's a really sweet ballad called Santa Fe that just goes on and has, you know, extensive guitar solos. And, you know, it's, I guess it's to keep it varied has always been our approach.
And everybody, everyone gets a say. That's always been a wonderful thing about it, is because somebody has an idea, and then somebody will pick up on that idea, or hey, what if we did this to it? And everybody's been able to dance that dance of like, wow, let's try that, or well, that didn't quite work, let's try this. And we really can bounce off each other, and we kind of roll with the punches really well.
Well, this is so much fun. We could go on forever.
Oh, it's going to be over?
There's only so much time.
There's a million songs.
Oh, my God.
You're right.
Well, how are you going to narrow down a set list for this show? Is it really hard?
Well, without Dean there, obviously, we're going to focus on Scott's songs, and they tend to be a little more melodic anyway, and he's just a fantastic singer. He's like our Robin Zander, and those songs were pretty easy to pick. I think we threw out two or three that weren't sounding very good, and then we added two or three.
We had to get some of the classic rockers in there too. They were not in there at first, but we had to pick up the pace.
All the big Something Brothers like anthemic songs are going to be there that night.
So good to see you guys.
Yeah,
so many people
Appreciate it.
Excited about this show. Tommy O'Donnell and Ed Pierce, the Something Brothers reunited April 8th at the Castle Theater. Man, good luck for you. Thanks for doing this. From everybody in Central Illinois, probably beyond, thanks for doing this.
Appreciate it, John.
Thanks, John.
That's Ed Pierce and Tommy O'Donnell, the Something Brothers, with John Norton. The group, along with Mojo Stew, the Mechanics, reunite Saturday night in a fundraiser. The song you're hearing is from the band's new EP. It's titled The World's Pretty Face.
When the silence comes,
I'm Willis Kern. At our website, WGLT.org, you can find individual stories and interviews heard on Sound Ideas and make your contribution to support this show and this station. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.